sedi, kaloku uphakamile. And no banda and che ulungi cabasha. I'm not going to put any time on what you are. You'll ask questions as much as you would want, wish to. If there is a second round, you'll get a second round, a third round, and a fourth round. I'm very generous. It's 2018. Yes. Thank you very much. Honorable Luyeng.
Thanks, Chairperson. Thanks to the responses that we got from Mr. Singh, which are actually an indication that we are in quagmire in this country as it relates to the manner in which state-owned enterprises are managed. Mr. Singh, can I ask you as to what salary level are you in at ESCO? Can't remember.
Was. I think my guaranteed remuneration was 4.6 million, I think it was.
4.6 million.
Yes. I think then there was pension contributions, I think, that we then need to add to that.
Are you aware that you are working for that huge SOE whose ability to sustain itself is actually the cornerstone of the entire country? Are you aware of that?
I am aware of that, sir, yes.
Are you aware of that? You are the asset manager of that institution. Are you aware that of the fact that all assets that exist in ESCOM are actually upon you as to whether ESCOM is coming or going in terms of sustaining the economic plight of the country? Are you aware that you are central to that? You are very important.
I am aware of that, sir.
Can you tell the country, if you are very proud of the service that you rendered at ESCOM, if all what has been said about you in particular and the role that you have played to ensure that there is stability, there is order in the management of ESCOM finances, are you proud of being that special person, special official?
Sir, I am indeed proud of what we achieved at ESCOM. If we can refer the committee to, just give me one second, to a page in the statement. Page 33, table 140. You will see that in the 15-16 financial year, we obtained an EBITDA of 32 billion, representing a 37.4% increase in that year. In the year 16-17, we established EBITDA of 38 billion, representing a 14.4% increase. And these were on the back of significant cost savings, which are also reflected in the table. Cash generated from operations increased by 36.4%, which is on page 34 of the submission. In 15-16, and 23.1% in 16-17. Liquidity was quite significantly improved, where we had funding percentages of 57% and 53% respectively. The energy and availability factor had improved quite significantly to 71% and then 77.3%. Capital delivery had come on stream. And those were some of the highlights that we achieved in the 2 years that I was there.
Mr. Singh, were you a board member?
Sir?
Were you a CFO?
I was, sir.
Is there any decision making that had actually taken place that you are supposed not to be unaware of, not unless you are not at work, because of your centrality in terms of the execution of your duty?
So yes, there would be a significant number of transactions that I would not be aware of as CFO. For example, procurement transactions that happen are originated by line. Procurement will respond to those requirements. As the advocate said, issue RFPs. The RFPs will be received, evaluated, and submitted through approval processes. We have delegations of authority, so to the extent that a transaction falls below a certain level, myself or the chief executive or any other ExCo member would not know of it. So there would be transactions that we're not aware of.
The general perception and a hypothetical view in the country that there is looting of state resources in South Africa, in particular at ESCOM as one of the state-owned enterprises. Do you belong into that school of thought?
Honorable Member, no, I do not. I think we have, I have, to the extent that I was allowed, have gone through pains to demonstrate the value that was created through the transactions that we undertook in each of the cases that we presented here today.
What grounds of justification can you provide in a situation whereby money, billions of rands, are paid out to companies that do not have existing contracts? How do you justify that fact? Is it normal?
So I think in terms of the, if you're referring to the McKinsey and Trillion contract, I think from where we sit, there was a contract between McKinsey and there was a contract between ESCOM and McKinsey. The contract required for a subcontracting relationship to exist. That relationship existed with Trillion at the time. The obligation to ensure that there was a subcontract lay with McKinsey, and there was work being performed. We undertook, through the Oliver Wyman process, a review of whether value was derived. We were comfortable at the stage that value was derived, and on that basis, a liability for the payment accrued. We settled with McKinsey, we settled with Trillion. In terms of a contract not existing, from my perspective, I went through the normal checks and balances relating to legal and internal audit and to ensure that value was delivered. ESCOM processes and practices allow for contractors to be or subcontractors to be paid directly. That arrangement is called a partnering agreement, I'm given to understand, and that's the process under which it was then settled. McKinsey and Trillion were not the only contractors to be settled like that. There were other examples where contractors were settled directly And it's a practice that has been undertaken in ESCOM. And I'm sure maybe other SOCs as well, I'm not sure.
What caused McKinsey to offer a payback of the 1.6 billion?
I'm not too sure, sir. According to the statement that they've issued, they are comfortable that the work was performed. They were comfortable that the contract existed and was valid between ESCOM and McKinsey. I guess from a reputational perspective, they've decided that they need to rectify the perception of wrongdoing or taintedness of that money by offering to pay back the money.
What is it that you are not sure of when you are really confirming exactly what McKinsey said? To say, I don't want this money because it is tainted. What is that you are not sure of?
Well, in my view, based on where I sit, I don't see where the money is tainted, because if they delivered value, they had a contract, they performed the work, benefits were derived by ESCOM, then they deserve the money. Hence we paid. Else we wouldn't have paid.
Well, there is no sinister kind of a showing when one claims that even if I am benefiting out of this, but I cannot be proud of benefiting out of an unscrupulous kind of a process, and the benefit is therefore tainted.
I'm not for 1 minute saying, sir, if they have concluded that they believe that the process was tainted and therefore they have to refund the money, I think they should. I'm certainly not advocating that they should not.
Mr. Singh, can you confirm whether you issued instructions after becoming the ESCOM CFO that all coal contracts had to be submitted to you prior to their conclusion for personal review? If that is the case, when did that actually occur, and for what purpose?
Sir, I must be honest, I don't recall issuing such an instruction. And if such an instruction were issued, it would be quite a voluminous amount of work for me to undertake. At the same time, running an organization as big as ESCOM. But there was a period of time when what we established was a primary energy steering committee that effectively looked at contracts that were in the process of being concluded, and we reviewed those contracts from a pricing perspective to understand whether there was comparability in terms of the pricing and the quality and so on and so forth. But I don't think I ever issued an instruction to say that every single thing must come to me. I don't recall that, sir.
Entailed in your submission, Mr. Singh, in an organization as large as ESCOM and complex as well, it is necessary to place reliance on its various departments or units. Why did you issue such instructions? Even if you did not issue an instruction, why did you allow a situation whereby you personally, before a consideration is made by your subordinates, subject to your confirmation if you are happy, considering the aspects you have alluded to, but why on receipt of that particular approach you want it to start from you?
Sorry, Honourable Member, I don't follow the question. If you can just repeat the question for me.
I am saying, in an organization big as ESCOM,
yes, sir,
there are different departments or different units.
Agreed.
And in those departments, there are relevant managers.
Yes.
who receive correspondence or approaches or proposals from outside. Now, how do you then allow a situation whereby you are concerned with these special projects, Eskom Primary Energy Division projects? You want those to start from you, not to be considered at the lower level.
No.
Because normatively, all the processes and policies and regulations as to how to manage tenders, it is done, and then at a later stage, it gets to your level. Then in this, why do you show that kind of interest that you want to ensure that you want this particular requirement?
Firstly, as I alluded to in my previous response, that was not the instruction that I gave to say that every single transaction must emanate from me. Secondly, the reason why we focused on the primary energy space is because, as I alluded to earlier in my statement, the cost of primary energy was increasing at 18% per annum over the last 5 years. If you have an 8% tariff increase only from NERSA and your cost of primary energy increases by 18% per annum, you're left with a significant shortfall in terms of the cash that is available to sustain the business. So one of the areas that we needed to focus on quite significantly was the cost of coal, and secondly, the use of diesel. And that's the reason why we started with the primary energy steering co. And again, the objective of the primary energy steering co was not to take over the functions of the managers in the primary energy space, was to review what they were doing. And that's all, and to understand the levers that are available for us to control the cost of coal. And that we did at a macro level. It was not at a transaction-by-transaction level.
Would you be that if there is evidence confirming that you caused a substantial delay to Eskom's procurement of coal from non-Gupta sources by delaying your reviews, the reviews that you referred to, of Eskom's prospective coal contracts?
I think there was delays in all contracts. I wouldn't say non-Gupta related contracts. At this point in time, when we were looking at these transactions for potential savings associated with the numbers that I've alluded to, and that was the only reason, sir.
If there is evidence that speaks to that, would you be surprised?
So, as I said, there was delays in terms of the contracts, given the fact that we had undertaken this new process. So, yes, there should be evidence to suggest that we delayed some of these contracts.
Was that not deliberate in order to ensure that there are these Gupta-related companies?
So certainly from my perspective, they were not deliberate. I can categorically assure you that. The main reason for us to review these contracts was primarily to ensure that we were arresting the spiraling increase in the cost of coal.
Are you aware of any coal delivered by Tegeta or any other Gupta-related company that was out of contract specification?
So that would be within the realm of the primary energy space and the generation space. However, I am aware through, media articles or stuff that was happening in the media, that Tegeta at some point in time was delivering out-of-spec coal. They were suspended for a period of time and then reinstated. But I think that happened before I was there. As I mentioned, Just Coal was delivering out-of-spec coal. The Optimum transaction, for example, was out of spec call in terms of the penalty that we discussed. So those are the three that I'm aware of, but the other details, I would assume that the operations guys are more close to that.
So what steps did you take, or ESCOM, how did ESCOM deal with that issue?
In terms of the just call thing, ESCOM cancelled the contract. In terms of the to get the supply that was out of spec, as I understand it, the supply was suspended. As I said, this is before my time, so I'm speaking based on information that has come to me over a period of time. I think the contract was suspended. There was a review that was undertaken, and I think the supply was then reinstated. On the optimum side, I think we've dealt with that in terms of what had happened on the optimum supply.
Mr. Singh, in your written testimony, you claim that you only became concerned about ESCOM's exposure to the significant financial risk under the $1.6 billion prepayment agreement once Ms. Daniels presented you with a copy of the draft agreement. You claim also that a significant financial risk was posed by the fact that the prepayment was approved in December 2015 and that the coal supply agreement would only become effective in March 2016. Then which coal supply agreement only became effective in March 2016?
It would have been the same coal supply agreement for the pre-purchase of coal, $1.6 billion. However, the same contract for the pre-purchase of coal contained suspensive conditions. Now, those suspensive conditions would have only been fulfilled by the 31st of March 2016, which is the date on which the contract would have become effective. So what that means is we would have paid $1.6 billion on, let's say, the 10th of December. The suspensive conditions would have only been fulfilled by the 31st of March. So between the 10th of December and the 31st of March, we would not have been able to take delivery of coal. So that is the financial risk that we were talking about in that period of time. So if the underlying contract for the supply of the 1.6 was for Arnott, then yes, it was for Arnott, yes.
The prepayment related to the existing coal supply agreement with Optimum Coal Mine.
So, Honourable Member, if the submission says Hendrina, then I would have to take it that it is Hendrina that we were referring to. In the agreement, in terms of the difference between Optimum and Tegeta, I think we explained that previously, that the there was an agreement between Optimum and Tegeta in terms of the coal supply. And that is why the agreement was with Tegeta and not Optimum directly.
Is it proper that the existing coal supply agreement agreed in 1993 would only become effective in March 2016. Is that appropriate?
No, sir. I think the coal agreement for 1993 was a separate agreement, which was the 150 rand a ton agreement, which resulted in the penalty of 2.1 billion. The 1.6 billion transaction that would have been effective by the 31st of March 2016 was a separate agreement that would have seen to get a supply ESCOM with 1.6 billion rand worth of coal over and above the 1993 agreement that you mentioned.
Now, maybe making use of your expertise and qualifications, can you explain the difference between a prepayment agreement and a guarantee for a layman's understanding?
Sure. A prepayment would be where you a buyer and a seller agree to deliver certain product, but in order for that product to be delivered, the buyer agrees to pay upfront for the goods. Normally, if you buy a bottle of Coke from Coca-Cola, they deliver the product and you pay that within 30 days. Okay? But under this agreement, instead of Coca-Cola delivering the Coke first to you and then paying, you now agreed to pay upfront before the Coke came. That's a prepayment. Now, what happened in this case, for us to, in order for us not to pay for the Coke upfront, as was envisaged in the prepayment agreement, because we didn't have the ability to take the Coke, we said we would substitute the actual physical payment with a guarantee. Now, the guarantee is a piece of paper that effectively says, when you finish off all these conditions and you have the ability to deliver the Coke, I will pay you the 1.6 billion rand. So it was a piece of paper versus the physical payment of the 1.6 billion.
Now, you know, all this kind of approach that let us prepay Tegeta in order for Tegeta to supply us with coal, and definitely coal is coming from a mine, and then you are giving that guarantee to Tegeta, who does not own a mine. Where is logic in it?
So I think, again, the logic exists to a certain extent in the fact that Tegeta had secured the coal from Optimum already. So Optimum didn't have the ability to say, okay, let us supply Eskom directly, as I understand it. And secondly, as I mentioned before in the testimony, we acted on guidance from the Department of Minerals in this case as well.
On the 11th of December 2015, Tegeta's CEO, Ravindra Nath, sent you an email in which he requested certain amendments to the guarantee. Maybe it's the guarantee in question. You'll have to clarify that. This included the exclusion of clauses 2.4 on the basis of such clause being an internal matter for ESCOM. Clause 2.4 of the draft guarantee, which had been sent by you to Ravindra Nath earlier on the same day, required Tegeta to obtain the necessary approvals in terms of the Public Finance Management Act. It is clear from the copy of the final contract, which is annexed AS6 in your attachments to written submissions, that you agreed to Ravindra Nath's request. Did you question Ravindra Nath's motives in making such a present request? Did you question her motives in making such a present request? And on what authority did you approve the request and exercise on the clause 2.4?
So that was discussed, and at the end of the day, PFMA and legal issues are pretty much not my domain. They're the domain of group legal, And it was decided that we should remove that and we put it as a condition to the contract.
Is it standard practice at ESCOM under your watch not to seek approvals under the PFME? So if that is the case, Mr. Singh, can you please provide a list of transactions where PFMA approval was not obtained?
So it's certainly not a standard practice for us not to request PFMA approvals if they are required. It's always a case that we seek guidance on whether PFMA approvals are required or not. And I think in my statement I have covered the PFMA process relating to the 1.6 billion in some detail.
In one's layman's understanding about PFMA, it requires that prior to ESCOM engaging in certain transactions, the ESCOM board must promptly and in writing inform the relevant treasury of the transaction and submit relevant particulars of the transaction to the Minister of Public Enterprises. What steps did you take to ensure compliance with the PFMA in relation to all the prepayment agreements and the guarantee entered into with Tegeta and our other Gupta-related company?
So if I were to refer you to my statement in this regard, I will try and get there as quickly as I can. December 2015, pre-purchase of coal. Page 23, paragraphs 71 through to 79 cover the steps that were taken for us to understand whether PFMA approval was required or not for this transaction. And there were a number of people that were involved in this assessment from the 23rd of February 2016 right up through the, I think it was 17th of March 2016. At the end of the day, I think the conclusion that was reached on this transaction was that given the fact that the transaction was never consummated, there was no need for us to get approval from the Minister of Public Enterprises. And even if the transaction was consummated, according to the emails that are contained in the documents, we would only need to notify the Minister of Public Enterprises of this transaction if it was concluded.
Did you ensure at the time that coal supply agreements entered into with Tegeta were reported to Treasury? Are you very sure even now? Can you really say you did actually make sure that Treasury was actually approached and an approval was actually received?
So I think certainly from a significance and materiality framework perspective, there are requirements that ESCOM needs to comply with to inform the Ministry of Public Enterprises relating to procurement transactions. I'm not too sure if there is a requirement for us to engage with National Treasury relating to the significance and materiality framework. However, amendments to the PPPFA Act required ESCOM and other state-owned companies to engage with Treasury relating to procurement transactions that met certain requirements. And that is the question that the advocate had posed to me in terms of ESCOM engaging with National Treasury for the extension of one of the contracts with Tegeta. So, yes, I think there are processes in place that would have allowed for that to be elevated through to National Treasury, but not from a significance and materiality framework perspective, but from a PPPFA compliance perspective.
You are claiming in your submission that Mr. Singh The 1.6 billion guarantee that was provided by Eskom to Tegeta helped mitigate job losses and the potential socio-economic risk. Were you then concerned about job losses and socio-economic risk when the Optimum coal mine was owned by Glencore? If so, why did you not assist Glencore or the business rescue practitioners in the same manner as you did to Tegeta? What is this? What is it that is special about Tegeta?
Well, I think I don't think there's anything special about Tegeta. I think it was a commercial decision that we had undertaken at the time. If you look at the proposals that were being provided by Glencore, they were not willing to, as I understand it at the time, entertain coal at the same price at 150 rand a ton in terms of honoring the agreement that they had with Eskom at the time. And also the penalty was an issue for them. I think they were quite keen on the proposal that was taken to the board in sometimes in 2014, as I'm given to understand, where the purchase price of coal was changed and the penalties were waived.
About the 2016 659 million prepayment, what has been the commercial value that was benefited by Eskom through that prepayment to Tegeta?
So I think certainly, as I was debating with the advocate, I think the commercial value was the 3.5% discount that we obtained, the fact that we didn't need to use diesel to prevent load shedding, which was the 5.5 billion, I think, that we quoted in the submission. So those are the benefits, commercial benefits that we derived, sir.
Mr. Singh, are you aware that during a meeting among Eskom, the business rescue practitioners of Optimum Coal Mine and Gupta family related persons on the 24th of November 2015, Eskom emphasized that it would not waive its penalty claim in respect of the coal quality under the coal supply agreement?
I was not at the meeting. I think I'm aware of the meeting, but I was not at the meeting.
In your view, what role did Eskom penalty claim play in the sale of the Optimum Coal share in Optimum Coal Mine and its other subsidiaries, subsidiaries to the Gupta linked together?
So in my view, I would think that it didn't actually play a role. I think Eskom had raised penalties on Glencore or Optimum Coal Mine in 2012 in order for us to ensure that Eskom's rights were still preserved. After a period of 3 years, claims prescribe. And as I understand it, the letter of demand that was issued to Glencore that triggered a whole series of events thereafter was meant to preserve Eskom's right in terms of being able to claim the 2.1 billion or a portion of the 2.1 billion in penalties.
I'm about now to rest my case, Chairperson. Lastly, Mr. Singh, in your responses to the evidence leader, and on the majority of cases, you have indicated that there are many other people that have to answer appropriately in as far as you are concerned. But I want to raise a concern that says, as a chief financial officer, all other people in that establishment on issues that relates to finances, it's your specialty, it's your area of specialty. It seems to be an element of maybe undermining the role of Parliament as it relates to you having to account about your activities in Eskom and the activities of Eskom rendering services in a manner that is transparent and equal opportunities existing there, accessible to all, especially South Africans. Seemingly, this local content arrangement does not work with Eskom. The 40 companies that exist in Eskom, I don't know as to how many were you considering to prepay now that you have left. Can you just indicate and I will rest my case there.
Thank you, sir. I think as outlined in one of the section two of my statement, I think there are a number of transactions that have resulted in prepayments. If you look on the coal side, historically, there were four or five transactions that were done, particularly under the 2008 coal mandate. Admittedly so, not to the value of 600 million, but certainly they were done. The capital that we provide to the cost plus mines, for example, in my view, are no different to a prepayment because we make available the capital up front and we get the coal over the next 10 to 15 years. One such approval that was done while I was there was the 1.8 billion rand Exxaro prepayment, not prepayment, but capital injection for the Matla mine. If you just give me 1 minute, sir, I will get to the section that I'm looking for. If you look at the 2008 mandate, Isambane was a prepayment was done, Linet was done, Silver Unicorn was done, and then obviously Tegeta. This is on page 67. If you look at the Cost Plus Mines, still on page 67, paragraph 46, there's about 17.5 billion that needs to be spent on Cost Plus Mines over the next 5 years, and we've spent about 11.3 billion to date on Cost Plus Mines. So these are specifically prepayments, in my view, that have been made in the coal space. If you look at page 68, sir, and specifically paragraph 47, prepayments that have been made to other companies other than coal is listed on the table there. And this was at the as at the 31st of March 2016, and it amounts to an amount of 3.9 billion. And it's for various different objectives.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mazon.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I'd like to start off by asking you a few quite straightforward and direct questions. Please could you tell me when you first met Salim Issa?
As I quite, I've already stated in my testimony, I can't remember exactly when.
All right, to jolt your memory, because this amnesia is becoming problematic. Could you describe what your relationship was with Mr. Salim Issa?
As I've said in my testimony already, I met with Mr. Issa maybe two or three times. It was for short meetings associated with any business opportunities. We never ever discussed anything relating to Trillion, not that I can recall or remember, and I should remember that. That was relatively recently, and we never discussed any Eskom or Transnet business at all.
Okay, well, that's a bit strange because you were at Transnet, then at Eskom, and you met to them for business-related issues. Could you describe to me what kind of business-related issues?
I think he was in the IT space at some point in time. I think he discussed that with me. Obviously, the consulting space, he discussed some of the consulting opportunities that he was looking at, but that was it. I don't recall any other.
Can you tell us when you first met Duduzani Zuma?
Don't recall meeting Mr. Zuma.
So you've never met Duduzani Zuma?
No.
Right. Have you ever met President Jacob Zuma?
I had the pleasure of meeting the president once, which was sometime last year after the State of the Nation address, to try and address the impasse relating to the renewable energy contracts at Eskom.
And at any time during your tenure as CFO of Eskom, because Transnet will deal with in a separate investigation, did you ever receive instruction that was told was given to you by President Jacob Zuma?
No.
No. How would you describe your relationship with Minister Lynn Brown?
Minister Brown and myself had, I would assume, a cordial working relationship. That was it. I called her, I never called her. She called me when it was necessary to have explanations of certain things, which I did, and that was it. And then obviously attended meetings or scheduled meetings that was called by her.
So cordial, good working relationship. Mr. Singh, I put it to you that you do have a relationship with at least one Gupta, and that would be Rajesh Gupta, who's commonly known as Tony Gupta. And it's also in the public domain, a string of emails that connect you directly to Mr. Tony Gupta. And as I've said, it's in the public domain, and a copy of these emails have also been handed up in Parliament by myself. And I'm going to need you to concentrate here, because your answers, I don't want you to unnecessarily perjure yourself, because you seem to have forgotten dates and times and places. One of the emails that's in the public domain is an email sent by Ashu, A-S-H-U, at sahara.co.za. That email informs the Oberoi Hotel that a one Mr. Anoj Singh is booked in at said hotel on the 24th of February. And it requires a pickup from Dubai International Airport from Emirates flight EK-766. And you stayed in Dubai for that period of time until 1st of March. So we're talking 5 days. Now also in the public domain is a series of invoices, which you have now in your possession because our evidence leader, Advocate Manara, gave you these invoices. And these invoices are billed to Sahara Computers. Now, could you explain to me why there is a coincidence that you don't know that Sahara was being billed on these invoices, and yet Ashu at Sahara was making travel arrangements for you to go to Dubai?
As I responded to Advocate Varana, the only people that I had communicated with relating to my travel arrangements was the travel agents. How Mr. Ashu came to communicate, I'm not too sure.
Now, I understand we all have a private life. We're all entitled to a private life. But we're not entitled to a private life when we're under a cloud of state capture and the possible consequences of billions and billions of rand being looted from our country. Why were you in Dubai for that period of time?
As I testified to Advocate Varana, I'm not sure relating to the 24th to the 1st of March. I'm not too sure of that date. It seems very long for me to be there in Dubai for 5 days. My trips are much shorter. And as I indicated to Advocate Varana, that some of those trips were business, some of them were private, and some of them were to meet with Mr. Al-Balushi. So from that perspective, it could have been that I was there for that purpose.
And when you were there to meet with Mr. Al-Balushi, describe who and what and why Mr. Al-Balushi is.
As I've said to Advocate Varana already, Mr. Al-Balushi is a businessman in the UAE. We met, and there were common interests associated with me wanting to understand the more workings in the UAE. He wanted to understand more workings about South Africa and Africa in general, establishment of businesses here, financial businesses in Dubai, and that's how we established a relationship.
Now, it seems, and you must understand how this looks very strange, you're the CFO of a state-owned entity that has practically the sole monopoly for energy production in South Africa. We've just heard that you're in about the 4.6 million rand a year bracket, taking into account perks, etc., etc. Now, outside business dealings from your attention at Eskom, is that not rather problematic? Because you're discussing business opportunities with this gentleman. Now, if these business opportunities aren't aligned to Eskom, why are you discussing business opportunities with him?
Ma'am, this was in my private capacity. It was not relating to Eskom in any way, shape, or form, or Transnet in any way, shape, or form.
Mr. Singh, yesterday evening, South Africa learned that you resigned from Eskom. Could you tell me why you resigned?
It followed the announcements over the weekend. I believe that I was appointed at the behest of the government of South Africa. I represent them. And over the weekend, I got to understand that there was a requirement for me to be removed immediately from my position. And I acceded to that request. I lodged my resignation with the company. It was accepted, and that's it.
Do you have a copy of your resignation letter with you?
Not on me, no.
Not on you. Do you roughly remember what you wrote in your resignation letter?
Basically it said that I was suspended, I was put on special leave on the 31st of July, subsequently suspended on the, in September. We still await any charges or formal charges following the suspension. But given the announcements over the weekend, we believe that it's in mutual interest for us to tender our resignation in terms of our employment contract. I think that was it. And they then responded and said they accept that.
You've just spoken in the plural. You said our resignation letters. Who else have you spoken to about resigning at Eskom? You've just said we tendered our resignation letters
and did it
in our mutual benefit.
I mean, it was between Hannes and myself that drafted the letter, so that's the reference I made to ours.
So in all of this, have you discussed your resignation with Mr. Prish Govender?
No.
So no talking to Prish. Right. Mr. Singh, let me take you back to the trillion question. It's now the infamous trillion question. And it's a question that I asked. And I asked the question specifically because, quite frankly, I knew the answer before it came to me. Now, you've just described your relationship with Minister Brown as cordial. I have to tell you, when Minister Brown was before our committee, her description of your relationship was certainly not one that was a cordial relationship. And your attorneys and advocates have been in this committee the whole time, and they can confirm this with them. In actual fact, Minister Brown in committee and under oath testified that she had been deliberately misled to provide me with the incorrect answer to my question. How would you answer that?
As I said in my response to Advocate Varana,
Mr. Singh, I want to explain something. You don't have to keep referring to your answer to Advocate Varana, because if I was happy with your answer to Advocate Varana, I wouldn't be asking a question.
Okay.
So we're leveling the playing fields here.
Okay.
Okay.
No, that's fair. The accusation of me being misrepresentation by myself emanated when I was in suspension. No one has actually addressed me relating to the purported misrepresentation that I have committed. The board has made that submission to the minister. The minister has made that submission to you. In my responses, I explained my understanding of that misrepresentation and where it could have come from. And as I said, I think responses that we had given were factually correct to the questions that were asked. The ancillary information that was then removed may have created the confusion.
Why do you think that ancillary information was removed? That sounds to me, A, either a complete conspiracy theory, B, a duck of accountability, or C, someone who really had it in for you.
I would think that, as I explained, the removal was basically to ensure that the response was very specific to the questions, as we've always done in the past. At that time, I didn't think it was anything sinister behind the removal of the information. And as I said, I think also, I'm not too sure who actually decided that the information must be removed.
Right, so this information is removed because you want to make it as easy for me as possible, I'm assuming, to give me a simple and direct answer. And in the removal of this information, the truth is misconstrued, and what you think was a truth now becomes an untruth. How do we deal with the situation now?
I think, in hindsight, we responded originally, but I think in hindsight, maybe we should have not removed the information, or the information should have not been removed. That would have provided, as Advocate Varana quite correctly pointed out, it was not my response, it was the response of the minister to Parliament. And maybe we should have given her the benefit of that information.
So, in the answering of this question, you've told us that McKinsey dealt with Trillion. You had very little to do with it. You were just dealing with McKinsey. You were paying McKinsey. They were giving you a service. What they did behind closed doors was their business. They carried on. You carried on. You just made sure they gave you a service. You gave them the money for the service. But what is also in the public domain are board meetings of Eskom of the 8th of December 2015, in which yourself and Mr. Machele Koko approach the board and absolutely encourage a relationship to develop between Trillion. Do you remember this board meeting at all? And I mean, maybe to jolt your memory, perhaps Trillion Management Consulting, if we get the full name, TMC, which is a 100% subsidiary of Trillion. Maybe that will help jolt your memory if we use TMC.
I don't recall attending the board tender committee of the 8th of December, if that's what you're referring to. I can only assume that the submission that was presented to the board tender committee was the motivation for the corporate plan that needed to be concluded. I'm speaking on correction, but I would assume that was the submission that was made. But I don't recall personally attending the board tender committee. But the submission relating to the corporate plan that McKinsey was engaged to perform was signed by myself and Mr. Koko. That one, that would have then served at the BTC. but I don't think I personally attended the BTC. And also I think the submission basically referred to a 30% subcontract. It didn't refer to the specific company by name, if I'm correct in that assessment. McKinsey decided on their subcontractor, and I think that was when the subcontract between McKinsey and Trillian relating to the corporate plan was consummated.
So at this point, I mean, now you must acknowledge that you knew that Eskom was in some way engaging with Trillian.
Oh, yeah. I've never denied that Eskom was engaging with Trillian.
Again, then I must ask you, why would Minister Brown, in a very simple question, and I'm going to actually read you the question, just so that we, you know, we're 100% okay on this. If you just give me a second. My question, have any contracts of engagement been concluded between Eskom and Trillian, and what are the costs involved in each case? The response was a very neat and very simple, none and not applicable. Now, I put it to you that you would have to be incredibly devious and have very sinister motivation to think that because you were working with McKinsey, who had subcontracted Trillian, that Trillian was not involved in the mix. Because a subcontractor works for the contractor that you're paying for. Now, the answer should have actually been quite simple.
I think, again, we answered the question directly and precisely in terms of the question that was posed. So from that perspective, I think it was quite transparent in terms of the question that was asked and the response that was provided.
You see, Mr. Singh, I'm going to respectfully disagree with you. I'm going to tell you that when you are the CFO of a major corporation, you tell the Minister of Public Enterprises that a deal that's going to go over R1 billion is being concluded by an international consultancy firm, and that a company called Trillian is being used as their front company to make sure that there is BEE compliance. I think you have a duty, both ethically and in terms of the PFMA, to inform both the board and the minister, and certainly a member of parliament when that question is asked.
Noted.
You see, Chair, it's not as simple as Mr. Singh would like to make out. Mr. Singh, I think that you are a technical genius. And I don't use that term lightly. Every possible loophole has been found. Every possible deviation made. To the point that Advocate Budlender wrote a report on the goings-on at Eskom. Are you familiar with the Budlender report?
I have not read it cover to cover, but I am aware of it, yes.
Okay. So, let me tell you, and you might want to write this down so you can read it later. Paragraph 67.1 of the Budlender report is revealed that Trillian Management Consulting, otherwise known as TMC, submitted an invoice with reference number ESK 2016-MC01 to you, Mr. Singh, on the 14th of April 2016. And I want to specifically mention the amount of money, because it is obscene. R30,666,000 for professional fees. But that's not where it ends. The Budlender report continues. In paragraph 67.2 and 67.3, it goes on to say that on the 10th of August 2016, two invoices, and I'll give you their reference, ESK 2016-MC02 and ESK 2016-MC03 for the amounts of 122,208,000 rand and 113,265,000 rand were submitted by Mr. Govender. Both. Now this is what astounds me. Both were paid on the 13th of August. Now in a company like Eskom that's not renowned for turning around an invoice fast, that's pretty impressive. 10th of August, and it's paid on the 13th of August. Now, where the huge problem and the huge dilemma comes in is that on the 18th of May, an article was published in the New Age newspaper, and it was entitled, Eskom Denies Contract with Trillion Capital. In this article, Eskom spokesperson, Mr. Pasiwe, categorically denied that Eskom had any contracts in place with Trillion Capital and or, and this is the important part, associated companies. At the point that the statement was made by the spokesperson of Eskom, did you take it upon yourself to correct him? Because, and with respect, if a CFO doesn't know about invoices coming in and out of a company amounting to this kind of money with a turnaround of 4 days, there's a problem.
So in terms of the turnaround, ma'am, I think there is a paragraph in my statement that deals with that. I certainly don't deal with approvals of payments that is done by the shared services center. And when I inquired of the shared services manager as to the turnaround of these invoices, he had indicated that the motivations that had been provided to him were satisfactory at the time, in that the work had been done way back when, and due to ESCOM approval processes being board tender committees and reviews by internal audit and so on and so forth, that these payments were quite delayed in terms of the expected date on which these needed to be paid. So that's the reason why he turned around the invoices quite quickly. The invoice of the 14th of April, was it? The 30 million invoice. McKinsey was actually paid in December, I think it was, and this invoice that was then paid in April was only paid in April due to the vendor management processes that were being undertaken by Eskom to register Trillion as a vendor on the system. And again, that was sufficient for the shared services manager to process that invoice. Then those were the payments. Your other question, ma'am?
When the spokesperson made the statement, did you rectify him?
I was not aware of the statement that was made by the spokesperson. I'm not aware of that article that you refer to. Had I been aware of that, I would have certainly corrected him in terms of the statement that he had made, the comments that he made.
Who would the spokesperson ask? Who would he go to and say, do we have contracts with Trillion or any subcontractors of Trillion? Who would he ask?
I think at the time, the official response that Eskom had given out at the time was that we certainly didn't have any contract with Trillion. I certainly didn't give out any impression that we certainly didn't have any payments that were made to Trillion, because that would be factually incorrect.
You see, Mr. Singh, this is the nuance and where I think that you're genius, is because you almost got it right, almost, to convince people that Eskom was not contracted to Trillion. But we now know that direct invoices were made from Eskom to Trillion, and direct payments were made from Eskom to Trillion. That means, regardless of whether or not you had a physical contract that was signed in front of you, the exchange of money tacitly implied that you had a relationship. Otherwise, why would you be exchanging these amounts of money?
Certainly, ma'am. Certainly, I didn't deny the fact that we had a relationship with, well, not that Eskom had a relationship with Trillium. The relationship that Eskom had was via McKinsey. And the work had been undertaken by both McKinsey and Trillium. There was an obligation to pay both Trillium and McKinsey. And that was a settlement process that then was undertaken. We did receive, I would say, permission from McKinsey to pay Trillium directly. I think it's even their policy for subcontracts to be paid directly. That is McKinsey's policy. It is Eskom. There is a process with an Eskom, which I referred to previously, which is a partnering agreement process that allows for subcontractors to be paid directly. So certainly, I think there was never a view that we did not pay Trillium. I mean, that would have been just not possible to contain because the amounts would have been paid.
Now, you see, I think you've just hit the nail on the head. It's impossible to contain.
Yes.
So why give an MP an answer that says no and not applicable? Because it's not true.
No, again, I think, as you say, it's technical because the responses to the questions that were posed were correct. The ancillary information would have provided the additional information that would have then allowed the minister to provide the ancillary information.
I think that is a very convenient answer, Mr. Singh, and I'm not buying it. And I don't think many other people are buying that answer either. Mr. Singh, let me tell you, there's a rather interesting term of phrase, and it's a code. And that code is used by the mafia. And that code is known as omerta. And it's a code of silence. It's an agreement to not comply with authorities. And it's used to keep syndicates safe. It's how they look after each other. But bar no form of syndicate, form of mafia, form of crime unit has ever managed to hold this code of conduct complete. No one has ever achieved omerta. Because someone must always speak because they get spooked, or they realize that they were unintentionally bought into a scheme that they didn't know about, or it's simply the right thing to do. Now, you've been watching this Eskom hearing as it's unfolded. And you will note many people have told us some very shocking stories. Very shocking stories. Mr. Singh, the one common denominator in all of these stories is you. They have come in and systematically described your involvement with state capture in a great deal of detail. And they have not accepted responsibility solely for things. They have shifted, I'd say, about 70% of the blame onto you. And when one looks at the PFMA, especially Section 66 of the PFMA, and when one looks at the startling occurrences over the weekend at Eskom, one cannot help but wonder, is there not a reason that this omerta was broken? Because the silence is broken. It's over. The game is up. The heist has been foiled. And I put it to you that state capture, especially state capture in Eskom, which you say you don't think is a real thing, I'm telling you, it is a very, very real thing. And South Africa knows it to be a very real thing. Now, one of your colleagues, who will appear here tomorrow, Mr. Mashele Koko, who was also suspended, then reinstated, he's been involved in many dealings that have passed a great deal of blame onto you. And I think, personally, one of the largest is the Tegeta prepayment. And perhaps the fatal mistake was a sense an overdeveloped sense of self-confidence that allowed a lie to become the most publicly admitted issue ever broadcast on national TV. And that's when, during a carte blanche interview, Mr. Coker was asked about the prepayment, denied it, and then when he was shown the evidence, he had to admit that it was true. Now, that prepayment could not have happened without you, and that denial, that constructed story, could not have happened without your input. Because Omerta only works if you both on the same page, and if you both have your stories together. So I want your comment, please, on why this prepayment was denied and only accepted as reality when hard evidence was given.
You're going to have to ask Mr. Coke that when he gets here tomorrow. But
it's funny, because I can promise you he's going to ask me to ask you.
As I led evidence, I was not the one that approved the prepayment. The prepayment was approved by the Board Tender Committee on the 11th of April, requiring me to do three things, which I did, and submitted to the Board Tender Committee on the 13th of April, that effectively agreed that I then signed the security agreement. And that's the only thing I signed. The agreement was actually signed by Mr. Coco.
Mr. Singh, it sounds to me like things at Eskom work very differently to other companies. Because let me tell you something. It might not seem like a large sum of money to you, but 600 million rand is a huge sum of money. And when you bounce these amounts up and down like this, certainly the CFO is consulted. Certainly you asked to look at these things. Certainly no one can make a decision like this alone. Who makes these decisions? How can a decision about a prepayment be made without the CFO's knowledge? Why are they bypassing you?
Well, that was one of the reasons why I was relatively annoyed when I found out about the fact that I had to do three things and not knowing about the meeting that happened the night before on the 11th of April. So notwithstanding that, given the fact that we needed to get the transaction concluded, we buttoned down and got the three things done that we needed to do.
Mr. Singh, on the 11th of April, because I know you're not remembering dates and you can't remember if you were at these meetings, so I'm just going to give you the dates and I'm going to give you the information so that we bypass that unnecessary step in the testimony. On the 11th of April 2015, the Board Tender Committee of Eskom sat in the evening, you were there, and it finalized amongst itself the negotiations for Tegeta. That was on the 11th of April 2015. And those board minutes are in the public domain. They're out there. So there's no question about them. Also out in the public domain is a letter from Tegeta, dated the 11th of April 2015. Where it says, it's addressed to Ms. Ayanda, and says, "Dear Sir," pity about that, "offer to supply additional coal to Eskom, Optimum Coal Mine Pty Limited." And it says, "kindly refer to the negotiations we had in the captioned matter," blah, 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 blah. This email was sent in the morning. The board only met in the evening. That means negotiations happened outside the ambient of the Board Tender Committee. How do we explain this?
Well, in response, firstly, I do confirm I did not attend the meeting of the 11th of April that happened that evening, because I only got to know about the fact that the meeting occurred the next day when Ms. Daniels informed me that I had three things to deliver to that same meeting. Else I would have heard it from the committee itself. In terms of the letter from Tegeta, I can't explain that. It was not addressed to me. I'm not too sure what the status of that letter is and the negotiations that were undertaken.
So as CFO, Chief Financial Officer, you had absolutely no knowledge of negotiations going on with Tsegeta. What the results of those negotiations were, you had no input into those negotiations, you had no say in those negotiations. A document was drafted without the Chief Financial Officer seeing it and agreed to, not in your presence. Is that what you're telling this committee?
For the prepayment of 659 million?
Mm-hmm.
That's correct.
Mr. Singh, in our country, negligence is not a defense. I'm going to end my questioning there for now, Chair, with one last point. In 2015, you were in Dubai in December, and I just want you, and I'm going to be perfectly honest with you, because I want you to be honest with me. As we speak, my PIA application to Home Affairs is in, because I want to check border control access in and out this country, specifically by you, because I want to make sure that this information is true. In August, you're appointed to Transnet. You're seconded from Transnet to Eskom, rather. Let's put it that way. You're seconded. In September, President Zuma appoints Minister Zwane, Mineral Resources Minister. In December 2015, President Zuma fires then Minister of Finance Nhlanhla Nene. Minister Zwane joins the Guptas in Switzerland to finalize the sale of Glencore's Optimum to Tegeta. Other Gupta allies are in Dubai, and these allies are alleged to be you and Mr. Coco. There is overwhelming and mounting evidence that you are part of an elaborate scheme to break up chunks of Eskom and sell them off to the highest bidder. I am now beyond the point of believing that you did not know about this and that you did not play an active role in this. I have lodged criminal charges against you because I have known too well that you are a technical genius who would come and try and spin stories here in Parliament. Mr. Singh, you know these charges are being investigated. I have given over all the documents. We both know what the truth is. And Mr. Singh, given your testimony here tonight, let me tell you what South Africa thinks. South Africa thinks that you have sold us out. You have sold us to the highest bidder. But South Africa has stood up and said no more. This committee is sitting here telling you no more. The game is up. And if I were you, I'd start spilling the truth. No further questions, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Mavone. Honourable Gordon.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Singh, is self-preservation in your case trumping conscience and ethics, if you understand the question? Is self-preservation trumping conscience and ethics? In other words, you have to survive at any cost, including lying, misleading. You know, all of us are getting messages from people who are watching this. I'll read you one, which is about the fifth one I think I've got. An urge taking you guys for fools. That's the impression you're creating amongst the public. So you're actually saying to South Africans, and your own family, by the way, the mother that you referred to earlier on, amongst others, that you will continue to stand here, continue to deny what you've really been guilty of, rather than own up and help the country cleanse itself of corruption. You don't feel any qualms about that. You don't think you want to change your tack. You don't think you've been poorly advised, with due respect to your lawyers. Is this in the face of all the political changes that are happening, how long do you think your story is going to stick?
Sir, with all due respect, I think the information that we've presented is factually based. It is supported by the evidence that we have, and that's all we can say, sir. I think the call has come relating to me moving on from ESCOM. I have complied with that call in terms of being able to resign, and we've provided this information also, or attempted to provide this information to the law enforcement agencies as well to cooperate with them. So we will.
But in nowhere there does it say I did this. Well, and it's well known, as Ms. Mazzoni was saying, you're at the heart of all of this.
I think where it was required for me to say that I did this, I was happy to say so. As I said before, if I did something wrong and there is a need for me to take accountability for that, I'm happy to do so. But where there is clear and unequivocal evidence of it not being in my area of responsibility, I've indicated that.
You barely took responsibility for anything. In normal business parlance, a big institution like ESCOM, if you equate it to a corporate, the CEO and the CFO are the two key people in that entity. Nothing moves, even operationally or in strategy terms, without the CEO or CFO being a key participant in the process. For the last 6-7 hours, all we've heard from you is, I don't know, ask so-and-so, these are the facts, I don't have any other facts. You've only been in the job for 2.5 years and you can't remember anything.
Sir, I think with all due respect again, the one area that I said that it was difficult for me to respond to the questions was relating to the Horong transaction. The rest of the transactions that I was asked to prepare on, I think I've been able to provide a quite sufficient detail in terms of the analysis of the transactions that was requested. In terms of the areas that I said that were not in my area of responsibility, related primarily to the legal issues and the legal aspects of the transactions. And that's the only area that I've deferred to. In terms of...
Okay, I'll come back to these points in a moment, but let me... I mean, you're very familiar, I'm sure, with corporate governance rules and so on, but clarify for me. In effect, from January 6, 2016, you've been both CFO and the head of Treasury, effectively, because Ms. Henry resigned in January 2016, at your behest.
Yes, she did resign.
At your behest?
Yes. There was a period of, a short period of time that I was acting in, that Treasury reported to me directly, yes.
But directly or otherwise, it still falls within the empire of the Chief Financial Officer?
Well, when Ms. Henry was there, it also fell into the CFO's portfolio.
No, right now, prior to your resignation and suspension.
Well, let's put it this way.
It's part of your portfolio of responsibilities.
When Ms. Henry was there, it was part of the CFO's portfolio. When she left, it was part of the CFO's portfolio, and it still is part of the CFO's portfolio.
That's all I was asking. So you can't say ask Treasury.
Yes.
You're asking Treasury is asking yourself in the mirror.
I agree.
Effectively. But the whole evening you've been telling us ask Treasury. As if Treasury is some other foreign entity sitting in Dubai. I mean, there might well be a Treasury sitting there. That's a different matter. You know, AS Global and all of that stuff. But we'll come back to that.
So I think when I said we needed to consult Treasury, it was on the basis that they are the relevant subject matter specialists in that area.
But ultimately, if you are the boss of finances in ESCOM, the buck stops with you, as the saying goes.
No, I agree.
So you can't say, I don't know about major transactions.
Sir, again, I would respectfully say that the Horong transaction was the only one that I said, if I had the opportunity
We should have kept a checklist here on a board and we've shown you how many crosses you would have made. about the I don't knows, but that's a different matter. So, you know, what people like you have done is ignored a very strong public view that is getting stronger every single day, that corruption is actually eroding South Africa's society and eroding South Africa's economy. Doesn't it worry you that you're part of that?
So I think corruption is a bad thing. I agree with that. I do not advocate...
Bad for others, not for you.
Sorry?
Bad for others, not for you.
No. I don't advocate it, and I do think that it needs to be rooted out. But what I don't agree with is the fact that I have been part of corruption.
In fact, people like you have earned South Africa a more recent reputation that we are a terribly corrupt nation, which is upsetting, I bet, 50 million South Africans at the moment, if not more. But just keep that as part of the conscience factor I mentioned earlier on. Now, in terms of good corporate governance, Section 195(1) of the Constitution requires that public administration must be governed by democratic values and principles. It goes on to say, and I quote, efficient economic and effective use of resources. Section 217 of the Constitution requires all of us as public office bearers or operatives in the public terrain to actually do the same. All the examples that we've talked about here, the bonuses to trillion for work barely done, the guarantees, the 600 million rands, more recently, you're probably going to say you don't know, but Tegeta's coal price, I believe, has been increased from 150 to 400 or thereabouts. The quality of coal, I think you call it the abrasiveness, as where the limit is 450, has been increased to 600. This is first-hand knowledge I'm talking about now. So much for, you know, the same criteria applying to every single coal supplier. Do you think in your stay both in Transnet and in Eskom, you've complied with these parts of the Constitution?
In my view, I think we have. There are, I guess, in Eskom as well as Transnet, there are robust processes that have been developed relating to PFMA compliance in Transnet specifically.
So that's where you get 5 billion rands going to Hong Kong for the locomotives. That's the robust processes. That's the free bonus, am I right? To the Guptas and so on. I mean, we'll call you back for that. But if that's the robust process you're talking about, it's weaker than a blade of grass outside.
So those are the procurement processes?
Of course, the CFO, you knew nothing about that, am I right?
You just
donated 5 billion rand of South Africa's public money.
The 5 billion rand, I'm not aware of, sir.
You're not aware? All South Africans are aware that for every 50 million rand locomotive, or whatever the amount is, 20% is actually going into an account in Hong Kong, but you're not aware of it.
No, sir.
Okay, at least we understand what your criteria for robustness is. Now, if I put it to you that you've actually been, and you've admitted to others that you're a director of Eskom until you left, that you're actually a delinquent director, you should be charged for that. And in terms of the Companies Act, a delinquent director is somebody who's grossly abused the position of a director, took personal advantage of information or an opportunity contrary to Section 76(2), intentionally or by gross negligence, inflicted harm upon the company or a subsidiary of the company, and acted in a manner that amounted to gross negligence, willful misconduct, or breach of trust in relation to the performance of the director's functions within and duties to the company. You're aware that you are a delinquent director?
Sir, I dispute that I'm a delinquent director.
Oh, okay. Why?
Because in each of the transactions that we've undertaken, we've demonstrated value to the organization. I'm not I don't recall the other categories that you've mentioned, but certainly in most of the transactions that we've undertaken here, we've demonstrated shareholder value that we've created.
Okay, let's look at the PFMA, which has an equivalent set of provisions. Reference has been made to 66, but I'll come back to that. Section 52A and B of the PFMA provides that individuals who are part of an accounting authority, and you'll know that state-owned entities, the board is the accounting authority, right, may not act in any way inconsistent with the responsibilities assigned to accounting authorities in terms of the PFMA. But you've accepted gifts. What's Mr. Balushi's first name, by the way?
Mohammed.
Mohammed. I was going to show you some pictures to work out which Balushi you're talking about on Google. But let's just, for example, take, you've addressed this several times, but here's an email from Gupta Leaks, which says that, greetings from the Oberoi, it's from Oberoi Hotels, direct to somebody called Sanjay Grover. Do you know Sanjay Grover?
No, sir.
Of course you wouldn't. Then this email from Sanjay Grover says, it's the 26th of December 2015 at 13:50. It says, forward bills for Mr. Anod Singh. And this is sent to Anshu Chawla. Then Mr. Anshu Chawla's mail is directed to Tony Gupta. Again, it says, Ray, bills for Mr. Anod Singh. And Mr. Gupta's response is, okay. You don't know anything about this either. No, we knew that. Okay, but you've actually violated Section 52A and B of the PFMA. You should be charged for that. Section 66 of the PFMA, other colleagues have tried to cover this under the guarantees that you actually gave without any authority. Did you inform Treasury about those guarantees? Because that's what 66 requires.
No, sir.
Okay, so that's a clean violation there as well. Then there's 52A again. This, again, one of my colleagues made reference to Ravindranath, so I won't cover that again. Then there's 54.2, which states that before a public entity concludes a significant business activity, the accounting authority, which is the board, which includes you, for the public entity must promptly and in writing inform the relevant treasury of the transaction and submit relevant particulars of the transaction, which would include, of course, the guarantee of 1.5, the special dispensation that you gave to Tegeta, and also the 1.6 billion rand deal, which involves McKinsey and Trillion as well. And you admit you didn't inform the Treasury?
No, sir.
Okay, so that's another violation. Then we go to Section 51B of the PFMA. You decided to terminate the coal agreement. And this 51A requires that the accounting authority for a public entity must act with fidelity, honesty, integrity, and in the best interest of the public entity. And if one actually puts this picture together of Tegeta, Mafube, Exaro, and the shenanigans around Arnott and Rina, in fact, it's a huge conspiracy to ensure that Oak Bay Resources gets access to this business. And all of you in the top management and the board of Eskom were part of this conspiracy. That's what I'm going to submit to you, and you're going to say no. Okay.
Now we accept your no. Your response is no.
I beg your pardon?
I would agree that we would say no.
Sure. No, we expect that of you. And the public out there expects that of you, too. Then there's Chapter 6 of the PFMA, Section 51.1. A, Roman numeral 1, an accounting authority for a public entity must ensure that the public entity has and maintains effective, efficient, and transparent systems of financial and risk management and internal controls, and an appropriate procurement provisioning system, which is fair, equitable, transparent, competitive, and cost-effective, which are, in fact, words that are used in the relevant chapter in the Constitution itself. All of what we've heard here, I want to put to you, is that very little cognizance was taken of this in respect of McKinsey Trillion. You admitted the Trillion was paid directly, am I right, by Eskom and its finance department without any contract existing. And similarly, I'm sure there's a lot of underhand deals that are going on that we don't even know about at this point in time. So there's a whole lot of other sections of the PFMA that in terms of the evidence before us, you've actually violated as well. And I think the committee will have to make up its mind about how it makes recommendations to the relevant prosecuting authorities in terms of this. Now, you made a number of references, again, in the governance submissions that you made, that to the BTC. But the BTC, am I right, is a subcommittee of the board.
That's correct, sir.
And therefore, it reports its activities to the board.
That is correct.
So any decisions taken at a BTC level ultimately are either noted, accepted, or amended at a board level?
I think, sir, the minutes of the particular meetings are attached to the board meetings.
But they are for their noting?
Yes,
for a start.
For their noting.
So if some board member is diligent enough and picks up something that, for example, a violation of the PFMA, and brings it to the notice of the board, if it had the right kind of integrity, they would intervene in that sort of situation.
Yes.
So all your references to the BTC, where you say that you didn't attend this meeting or the other meeting, it's actually quite irrelevant, because as a member of the board, you have all those minutes, as you just pointed out. So technically, you're aware of everything that goes on in the BTC through its minutes, whether you were at the meeting or not.
Subsequent to the event, sir.
Yeah.
Yes.
But if it's a serious, again, violation, and if all things were equal, you would act in the right kind of way. So I want to, in terms of governance, Chair, round up by saying that, in fact, Mr. Singh and people like him should, in fact, be declared delinquent directors, should not hold board positions anywhere in any company in South Africa, and have a lot to answer for to the State Capture Commission when Deputy Chief Justice Zondi begins his processes. Let me then move to the famous family. Did I hear you correctly saying earlier that you encountered one of the Gupta brothers in the lobby of the Oberoi Hotel?
No, sir. I said that I may have met them in passing in the Oberoi Hotel.
That's strange, because at the time you were at the Oberoi, the one instance, which was the 17th to the 24th of December 2015, Atul Gupta was there at the time. Varun Gupta was there for part of that time. And let me see, according to my records, Tony Gupta was there part of the time. Ronika Raghavan was there. Tuduzani Zuma was there. A little before you, Mr. Zwane was there. And then there's a long list. Mr. Van Rooyen, Mr. Moyane, Mr. Gift Makashule, Mr. Tato Makashule, Kim Davids, who's been in the news recently. Then in January, Mr. Mancha, Mr. Koko, and Mr. Siyabonga Gama, according to information that I have. And it must be a really big hotel, because you didn't encounter any of these people in the breakfast room, dinner room, massage room, because you had massages there, according to the bills.
No, sir.
No. Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. Now, this guarantee of 1.6 billion rand to Tegeta, just remind us, what was the purpose of the guarantee?
The purpose of the guarantee was to ensure that we secured the coal from Tegeta during the period that Tegeta required to fulfill the substantive conditions.
It's quite a coincidence that at the time when you were considering the guarantee, according to Mr. Marsden, the business rescue gentleman who appeared before us last year, I think on the 1st of November or thereabouts, said that the selling price of the optimum coal mine was $2.15 billion, that money was found to the tune of about $1.55 billion, which is very close to the $1.6 billion. Am I right that it came from the Bank of Baroda? And that indirectly your guarantee was in effect to the Bank of Baroda. What did you use as collateral with EFSA for the $1.6 billion guarantee?
It was backed by cash, but it was in the name of EFSA.
Mm. The $23 billion the Treasury gave you?
No, the $1.6
billion, sir. No, I know. Where did the $1.6 come from? It was about the time that the $23 billion rand in cash was also given by the Treasury. Am I right? National Treasury.
I think it was the $10 billion first tranche that had come at that time, yes, sir.
Right. So the assertion, ladies and gentlemen, is that this is a funny round-tripping, you see. The National Treasury is asked for help. 23 billion rands is announced in the budget. The first tranche of 10 billion rands is paid over. Part of that 10 billion rands is used to put in cash of 1.6 billion rand into the account to generate a guarantee of 1.6 billion rands. And we don't want to go into the details of the transaction, but then the Bank of Baroda comes to the party. And I'm sure we're going to hear about the Bank of Baroda a lot in the near future to offer the 1.6 billion rand. So you actually assisted, not the coal supply, but in fact there was a conspiracy between DMR, yourselves and others, to make sure that Optimum Mine changes hands and goes into the Oak Bay family, so to speak, which is the public impression, by the way. So what we then left with is about 600 million rands. And that is politely and euphemistically called prepayment. Right? Because I don't know what's the need for a prepayment. You're producing coal, you deliver the coal, you get paid for the coal. Prepayment, as I understood it, is for capital investment. Is that correct?
In most cases, yes.
In most cases. So here, what are we paying for? So we were actually, if you put the sums together, we were actually consciously and connivingly assisting Oak Bay Resources to purchase this. I mean, if you include all the private jets that were used, I think you traveled in one of them.
No, sir.
Is the belief. I believe it's stuck in where? Basel at the moment.
No, sir.
Oh, okay. So you don't know anything about Bombardier planes, do you?
No, sir.
Okay. Let's come to Trillion. Now, at Transnet, who was the head of your... I think you had a board tender committee, am I right? Of sorts. Might have been called something else.
A board acquisition and disposals committee.
The chairperson of which was? Shouldn't take that long, man. Come on.
Mr. Sharma.
That's right. That's right. And who was a close associate of Mr. Sharma? Mr. Issa, whom you've met on a few occasions.
Yes, sir.
So the Sharma-Issa-Singh axis is quite an interesting one. From locomotives to mines to consultant deals. And I'm sure that lots of people will be interested in that relationship as well. How many times have you met Eric Woods?
Very often.
Very often?
Yes.
To discuss? Resources?
Sorry?
To discuss?
Business-related stuff, like the stuff that we've been discussing.
Many of your people that you work with at Eskom actually say that you give instructions continuously, that business that actually could be done by professionals in Eskom must actually go via Trillion so that Trillion can earn some money, that's putting it in a mild way, from Eskom. And, of course, you're going to deny that.
I categorically deny it. I've never given that instruction.
Well, I think the public should know. The public should know about these things. Okay, this is my last set of questions, Jay, is around finances, and if we hear at midnight, we'll ask some more. The financials that you read out earlier on were from the 15-16 financial year, where you showed EBITDA of 32 15, and so 16 on.
15-16 and
16-17. 16-17. So why does Eskom find itself in a liquidity crisis now?
I think it's more associated with the, let's call it, issues relating to state capture, corruption, and so on and so forth. It's,
which are lies anyway, so what's the problem?
Well, I think it's more the issue around perception rather than the...
So it's all perception?
No, I'm not saying that, sir. What I'm saying is that the investors have the right to assume that these things are happening. They've requested that...
Are you calling investors fools to believe in perception?
No.
Oh, then?
I'm saying that the...
Is there some basis, in fact, on which investors base what they say?
I think we've tried to present today, through this evidence, the process that we've undertaken to get to the conclusion of these transactions. I think...
No. The question, Chair, is there any basis, in fact, in the idea or practice of state capture that investors are, in fact, taking note of?
I think they are.
Or is it all fiction?
No. I think they are taking note of all of these things that are happening, and they quite rightly
say... In Eskom?
In Eskom and in the country.
But you just said there's nothing happening in Eskom.
No, I said the perception of...
No, that's what I'm asking you. Now, let's be clear. You mean the investors that you go on roadshows and meet, I'm sure they're all keen to hear your answer about how you evaluate your interactions with them. I've had many, as you know, myself. So, are you saying that those investors don't know what they're talking about?
No,
are they believing falsifications about what's happening in Eskom, and that in fact there's no basis to believe that corruption and state capture is a major factor in Eskom?
No, sir, I am not saying that, sir.
What are you saying?
I am saying that they have the right to believe those perceptions.
No. Are there facts, not perceptions? Are there facts that on which they are basing what they say?
I haven't engaged with them directly on any of these matters, sir. The last time I engaged with any of the investors was probably before July.
In March 2016, I met PIMCO representatives in London. And the one thing they said to us clearly, we might buy other bonds in South Africa, corporate and government. We will never buy Eskom bonds. That's March 2016. But that, as you call it, that's fiction.
No.
PIMCO doesn't know what it's talking about.
No, I wouldn't.
The largest bondholder in the world doesn't know what it's talking about.
I would.
Only Anuj Singh knows what he's talking about. Does PIMCO know what it's talking about? Only Anuj Singh knows what he's talking about.
I think PIMCO does know what it's talking about, sir.
Thank you. Now, how many downgrades have there been in your time at Eskom?
Two, if I recall correctly, sir. Well, actually, one.
One. That's into double junk territory.
I think so. The one that I mentioned in the report.
I think if you go and check it out, it might well be two. And, of course, rating agencies don't know what they're talking about, too.
I wouldn't say so.
Fitch, S&P, Moody's. Their matrices are all wrong.
No, I wouldn't say so, sir.
They won't say so. Their concerns about corporate governance in Eskom, procurement practices in Eskom, corruption amongst the board and senior management of Eskom, unfounded.
Sir,
nonsense. They should believe Anuj Singh. Nothing is happening in Eskom.
Based on the objective evidence that we've provided today, sir?
No, I'm not talking about today. Let's talk generally. You've been in Eskom 2.5 years. That's one small file. And you know it as well as I do. Are ratings agencies basing their ratings on facts and clear understanding of the trajectory, financial, economic, and governance of Eskom, or are they dreaming?
I think on the governance issues, I think they certainly are taking a leaf from media reports and the like. Certainly on the...
Only media reports?
No, I mean media reports and interactions with management and so on and so forth.
Which includes you?
Well, I haven't...
And your former friend, Mr. Molefe.
I haven't interacted with them since July. They wouldn't have interacted with me relating to these issues.
So, do ratings agencies have a basis to be concerned about the goings-on in ESCA?
Again, as I would have said...
Yes, no.
Yes.
Thank you. Why do local banks, until Sunday, refuse to lend money to ESCA?
For the similar reasons.
Maybe. Similar reasons.
Yes.
And yet, you're telling us for the last 6 hours, everything is fine in ESCA, until you were suspended.
I did not say that everything was fine in Eskom.
No, no, a few aberrations. Yeah, we understand that. But everything else is fine. Anuj Singh was in total control of the finances. Nothing wrong happened under his watch. Every contract was sound unless he saw it or didn't see it. That's your story. Because everything else is deflected to the Treasury, to the BTC, to memos that went there without you knowing, meetings taking place without you being invited. Blame Suzanne Daniels, blame everybody else. But I'm not saying straight man.
But sir, as I said to you before, if there was accountability that need to be taken, I would take it. If there was...
Of course you must take accountability. There have been downgrades on your watch. There's a liquidity problem on your watch. You've been part of bringing Eskom down to its knees, the biggest utility on the African continent. Fourth or fifth biggest in the world. You've been part of the team that brought it to its knees.
Sir, I think I demonstrated that in the 2 years that we were there, we certainly improved the liquidity, we improved the profitability.
Improved where? You went up like that and came down very fast.
Sir, coming down was...
nothing to do with Anuj Singh.
Well, I was suspended on the 31st of July.
That's a couple of months ago. Between friends, you know what I mean. Not that we're friends, just in case we misunderstand each other. So we have a liquidity problem. We have a confidence from investors. People wouldn't buy your bonds. And I'm sure the deputy president of the country didn't encourage the kind of changes we've now seen in the board and so on, just because somebody had the perception that something is happening wrong. You must be genuinely concerned. But you still, as Anuj Singh, don't want to make any concessions to us that X and Y was corrupt in South Africa, in Eskom. That A and B were wrong governance practices. That many of the members of the board from 2011 were in fact captured. No concessions.
If that was in my direct knowledge, I would have responded.
This is going to encourage more people to send SMSs to all of us now. You see? You should get a video of your evidence here today and your interactions with us and ask yourself, is this really you? Is this really you? I mean, you are literally taking us for fools. And that's not even our view. That I mentioned early on until I saw all the SMSs and other messages coming through. What does it mean to have a going concern problem as far as auditors are concerned? Explain to the public that's watching.
You should be able to meet your liabilities for the foreseeable future, which in the auditor's terms is probably around 18 months. 18 months.
18 months.
Yes.
So, by the end of this financial year, what is required to be declared a going concern, from your knowledge?
I think we would have probably needed to secure at least around 50% of the funding, which is around 60 billion per year, I would think around 30 billion.
So, the immediate need seems to be in the area of 10. And by the end, ladies and gentlemen, of this financial year, or the new one, 18-19, it's going to amount to 40 billion rands. And yet we say, for the last 6-7 hours, under your watch, everything should actually be awarded a Nobel Prize. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Gordon. I will now have Honorable Teddy.
Mr. C, you seem to be having a short memory, and I'm sure since we started with this interaction this morning, the events that some of the colleagues spoke about at least gives you an idea or reminds you that some of the clauses or sections of the PFMA that you have floated is 53A, that a member of an accounting authority must disclose to the accounting authority any direct or indirect personal or private business interest that the member of any spouse, partner, or close family member may have in any matter before the accounting authority. Surely what we have been dealing with since this morning suggests that this is one of the sections that have been floated. What's your take on that?
So if as Advocate Varana had put it, if we take the the purported emails at face value, then yes, there may have been a contravention of that section. But on my version of the emails or the invoices, I would suggest that there's no contravention of that section.
Earlier on, while you were interacting with Advocate Varana about your Dubai visits, which you insisted that they were not necessarily private visits, professional visits, because a certain Arushi had an interest in terms of some of the businesses that are happening in the country. You insisted there's nothing to do with the Guptas. I'm sure you remember that. My question is, if these visits were professional, not private, why would a private person pay for such visits?
So I did distinguish between professional and personal visits. The professional visits, in my earlier response, related to work that I've been doing for Eskom and Transnet in terms of visiting rating agencies as well as investors in the Middle East. The interactions with Mr. Al-Balushi would form part of the private visits that I was undertaking.
So you agree these visits were private?
Yes.
So it goes back to what I was saying earlier about 50.3A. disclosing to the entity business interest. Did you do that at some stage?
No. There was actually no business interest that we actually consummated. It was more around discussion, advice, and so on and so forth that we were engaged in.
Okay. You claim that the 1.6 billion guarantee that was provided by Eskom to together help to mitigate job losses and socioeconomic risk. Were you concerned about these job losses and this socioeconomic risk while the Optimum coal mine was owned by Glencore?
So I would assume that the organization would have been concerned about it. At the time, this transaction happened in December. I was appointed in August. I'm not too sure what the organization's view was prior to that.
I'm not talking about the organization. I'm talking about CFO of the entity, state-owned company. About the organization. I'm talking about you yourself as the CEO of the state-owned company.
I guess if...
Very huge state-owned companies. Other colleagues have indicated earlier.
So we'd be concerned for job losses in any company? as a state-owned company, because one of the objectives that we have is to ensure that we preserve jobs.
So why didn't you assist Glencore or the business rescue practitioner in the same manner you did with Tiget?
Because as I mentioned before, sir, that one of the criteria that we would use is to understand whether Glencore was going to supply coal at the same price or not. And Glencore and the business rescue practitioners at the time, as I'm given to understand, was not willing to supply coal at 150 rand a ton. That is one of the reasons why they put the business into business rescue, because it was not profitable.
In your testimony, you admit that Eskom paid 1,495,000,000 since 2016. Do you admit that the money need to be recovered somehow from Trillion and McKinsey?
So I, as I alluded to earlier in my testimony, in our view, work was done, the amounts were accrued in terms of the contract, the amounts needed to be paid. How Eskom would go about trying to recover the money from Eskom and Trillion, sorry, from McKinsey and Trillion at this stage, I'm not too sure. But maybe a legal person would be able to provide you with a fuller analysis on that question.
McKinsey, when we interacted with McKinsey earlier, sometime last year, they indicated that they are ready to pay back the money. What's your take on that?
As I alluded to earlier in the evening, if McKinsey is of the view that they need to pay back the money, they should do so.
But you agree?
Agree with?
That Eskom did not derive value for money with regard to all these monies. As I've indicated, 495 million. We're not talking about the thousands. 495 million.
So the statement that I provided goes into some level of detail to explain how Eskom had derived value through the master services agreement with McKinsey. So no, I do not agree that there was no value derived.
The medium-term coal mandate that you spoke about earlier, that you used to negotiate and conclude contracts, can you talk more about this medium-term coal mandate?
It is a mandate that was adopted by the board in 2008, that was adopted post the coal crisis. You'll recall that there was a shortage of coal at Eskom in 2008, and that the reason for that shortage was, as I understand it, there were a number of contracts that came up for renewal at the same time, as well as the fact that the export price of coal was quite high. So local suppliers were favoring exporting coal rather than supplying Eskom coal locally. I think that was one of the reasons that prompted the Department of Public Enterprise at the time to try and classify coal as a strategic resource.
If you were the CFO then, because this medium-term coal mandate was agreed upon by the board sometime in August 2008, before you arrived. If you were the CFO then, would you have advised the company to go the route of this mandate, where more than 100 million contracts can be awarded to the company without having gone the tender route?
I think there would have been a need for the organization to put in some measure to stabilize the organization post the coal crisis. I think one of the things that we would have done was to terminate the 2008 coal mandate earlier, once the crisis was overcome, if you want to call it that. I think the board, in its wisdom, terminated the 2008 coal mandate in September 2017, I think it was.
So you still don't see anything wrong with this mandate where over 100 million contract can be awarded to a company without having gone the tender route.
No, sir.
So there's nothing wrong.
I did say that there is something wrong with it, and that is why the board terminated the mandate in 2017. What I did say, though, is that in 2008, there was a coal crisis, and there would have been a need for the 2008 mandate to be put in place to alleviate the crisis. But post, maybe, I would say, maybe in 2010, for example, or 2012, maybe the 2008 mandate should have been reviewed and a new mandate put in place. So, yes, I would assume, I would respond and say, yes, there was a problem with the mandate and it should have been reviewed earlier rather than in 2017.
Okay. Let's go back to your Dubai visa. Since you became CFO, how many times have you been there?
CFO of Eskom or Transnet?
CFO of Eskom.
As I said, sir, I've been there a number of times. I can't recall the exact number of times that I've been there.
On private business?
A private or business, sir.
Okay. As much as you have indicated, you don't even recall you meeting the Guptas there. No, at no given time.
As I said, in passing, I did meet them. I did not have any formal meetings with them at any stage, no.
Okay. I want to conclude, Chair, but I must equally indicate my disappointment. Earlier on, some of the honorable members have said we've been receiving quite a number of SMEs from people who had thought the former CFO will assist this committee to probe the floating of procurement processes and also to try and expose acts of corruption in the entity. People are disappointed, I must tell you, with the manner in which you have been responding to the questions that we have been posing since this morning. But nevertheless, it's up to us to see how best do we conclude this particular matter with regard to the manner in which, but I must indicate that really we are disappointed, like the rest of the people who have been sending us SMSs. Thanks.
Honorable members, can we take just a 5 minutes break just to stretch our legs and our backs from sitting? Just 5 minutes, strictly 5 minutes.
You said I can go on record to say I have not received a bribe of any sort or taken a bribe from anybody. I think as it relates to the gifts, I will be submitting a tell-all document. So let's just wait for that and we will see where that lands up. Now, you've also explained that that document is the submission, but there's no mention in that submission of any gifts that you might have received. What did you mean by that, the gifts that you might have received?
I think the question that was posed at the time by the journalist referred to the trips as gifts. I think that was the context within which that that question was asked.
And you still deny that any of those trips were paid by any Gupta-related person or Sahara or anything like that, notwithstanding all the invoices that have been showed to you, notwithstanding overwhelming evidence?
Yes,
you still deny that?
Yes, sir.
Now, our standard of proof here is a balance of probabilities. And it's your word against all those other invoices. Why should we believe you? You understand the problem that we've got when it gets to credibility, when it places you, and when we look at the overwhelming amount of evidence that is building up around you. And that's why I plead with you, like Mr. Gordon pleaded with you, to give us a full explanation You see, it's very clear to me, if, and I've done a study of the Transnet documents as well, and the involvement of yourself, Mr. Malefi, in assisting Gupta-related companies, Mr. Salim Issa. And we'll get to that in the subsequent Transnet inquiry. But then we see Mr. Malefi going across the Eskom after the previous CEO, Ms. Molefe, was CFO, seemed to be an obstruction. For example, failing to sign the TNA breakfast contract. And she was fired. And a while later, we have Mr. Molefe going across as the CEO. And then subsequently, you go as the next CFO. And the pattern that is developing is of the whole process of facilitating Tegeta, facilitating the TNA, and facilitating the whole narrative of state capture. Now, you'll obviously deny that, but what I have to put to you, as others have, is that there is overwhelming evidence that is in the public domain, and that you're going to have to face in this forum and in other forums. Are you defending the Helen Suzman Foundation court case against you in your personal capacity? Have you filed a notice of opposition?
Yes, we will defend that.
I beg your pardon?
Yes, we will defend that.
And you've noticed that the Minister of Finance and National Treasury is supporting that application. Do you not see that the cards are falling? Do you not see that, as Mr. Gordon indicated? Do you still stick to your version, and it's very elaborate and there's a lot of documentation there, but that nothing untoward was done on your watch, whether by omission or commission?
Sir, I can only speak to the documentation that is before us and the evidence that is before us, and that is what I've read today.
Okay, so then let me take you through some of the documentation. When Mr. Molefe arrived at Eskom, at that stage, OCM was negotiating on the hardship clause relating to Hendrina. There was progress made in that regard. He confirmed in his evidence that the request for revised Hendrina coal supply was being favorably considered by Eskom before his appointment. Suddenly that is then stopped by Mr. Molefe. He might have had good reasons, but again it plays into the narrative of him wanting to benefit Tegeta. And that was the finding of the public protector. You recall that because you made a representation to the public protector. The public protector said Eskom leant over backwards to accommodate Tegeta. Do you still believe that Eskom did nothing to benefit Tegeta unfairly?
The policies and processes that we needed to comply with, we've complied with the policies and processes.
On the 1st of July 2015, so we understand that OCM was having financial difficulties. July 2015, OCM, Glencore, secures additional funding from Glencore to enable it to continue supplying Eskom. Suddenly there's a problem, because now the plan to get Tegeta to take over is going to fail, because OCM now has its own funding and it can continue. So what happens on the 16th of July? Eskom serves a notice to claim historical penalties suddenly, out of the blue. Never having mentioned it in the past, Eskom then imposes a penalty. The pressure starts to build on Optimum Miles, coal mines. In August, the department suspends the mining operations at OCM with no lawful basis. The pressure increases. The public protector says it can only be interpreted that Eskom wished to exert pressure on OCH and OCM. we see the allegation that your former board chairperson, Mr. Ngubane, is alleged to have approached Minister Ramat Lodi to suspend all the licenses of OCM. Are you aware of that? It's denied by Mr. Ngubane, but is there any reason why that former minister would lie and say he was approached to put more pressure on OCM?
I'm not aware of that, sir.
I'm sure you've read of that in the media.
Yes, I have.
There's a contention. Immediately, that minister is then fired and replaced by Mr. Msebenzi Zwane, who then plays a greater role in facilitating the Tegeta deal. Are you aware of that? Organizing it in Switzerland, going to Switzerland. And you indicated the role that the department also played in this, the Department of Minerals now. So you see the pressure building up. Do you understand the narrative? Sorry, continue. I'm asking you, are you aware of that, the pressure building up on OCM?
Via the narrative through the media, yes, I'm aware of that.
Well, I'm putting These are facts that are in on affidavit. These are facts that have been disclosed by media houses, and these are facts that are on affidavit in the court case that you have to answer.
So, firstly, in terms of the facts that you mentioned, where you say that... in terms of the facts that you mentioned relating to Glencore never being aware of the penalties prior to July, I think it's probably disingenuous to conclude that that was a fact, because they were negotiating the revised contract with the board in November, December 2014, which required the penalties to be waived and the price to be increased. So for them to say that they never knew that the penalties existed is...
Well, I'm sure you have the opportunity to respond in affidavit to those allegations as well. All I'm sketching is a time, chronological time frame of how the pressure was increased. What I couldn't understand was when the whole deal was put together and the guarantee, which we know there were illegalities related to the guarantee, such as the approvals, the board approvals that you admitted were not obtained. And then secondly, the prepayment. Why that prepayment? And you say there was no problem with the prepayment of the 659 million. Do you still believe that there was no problem with that prepayment?
So firstly, sir, I'm not too sure where I admitted that approvals were not obtained.
The board. It never went to the board, the BTC. Are you correct in that? Well, let's just
get the guarantee.
No, I'm talking about the first guarantee. The first guarantee, right?
Yes.
1.8. You said it did not go, it was not lodged with the BTC.
No, with the board.
With the board.
Yes.
You admitted that.
But
you said it was for some reason it was not lodged. Is that correct?
No. There's a difference. In my statement, I say I had the requisite authority from the board to issue the guarantee. Then the question was asked, why was it not reported? And I explained why it was not reported to the board. There's a difference between...
But it should have been reported.
It should have been reported.
Well, that is what I'm saying. That's basically, okay? So there is...
But there was authority for me to issue the guarantee.
I appreciate that, and thank you for that.
And then secondly, on the 659, in terms of whether it was okay or not, I think certainly it followed all the processes and procedures, and it was issued, and the 659 was made in terms of the 2008 coal mandate, which allowed for prepayments to occur. I've mentioned other prepayments that were made to Cost Plus Mines and other prepayments that were made to other coal miners under the 2008 mandate. We got commercial value for it. So, again, in terms of the policies and processes that we needed to comply with, we complied with those policies and procedures.
Why was it paid to Tegeta and not to the business rescue practitioners, as it should have? Because at that stage, the mine was under the control of the business rescue practitioners and not Tegeta.
I would Has it to say that the business rescue practitioners didn't have a bank account of their own?
No, I'm sorry. That's nonsense. You know it was part of the purchase price.
No.
They laid a complaint with in the Hawks. It was never investigated because of that whole... And you know that.
The question that you posed was why to the business rescue practitioners. The business rescue practitioners manages the business on behalf of the owners. So they would never have a bank account of their own. It would have to be paid to Optima. Okay.
Well,
firstly,
they weren't even aware of the payment. Let's just put it that way.
Firstly,
they were surprised. Mr. Marsden's evidence was he was surprised about that payment in total.
So,
and he then made the statement to the Hawks where he laid a criminal complaint. A criminal complaint, and you still say that that payment was in order.
From an ESCOM perspective, the payment was in order. The contract existed between Tegeta and ESCOM. So who was it supposed to pay? If I paid the business risk practitioners, or if I paid Optimum, I would be saying exactly in the Trillion McKinsey problem that we just say that is so bad as well.
Well, we differ on that aspect, and I'm sure the criminal authorities will be investigating that. Sadly, as Mr. Marsden indicated, it was only about a year later when the Hawks approached him, but there seems to be an increased interest in that more recently. But one of the things I found very interesting, I couldn't understand how Tegeta was going to benefit from buying the Optimum coal mining to provide Hendrina at 150 rand per ton. How could they? Because there was something that had to be done to ensure that they would make a profit. Now, the only way they could do that was to ensure that ESCOM cancelled or didn't renew contracts to Arnott so that Optimum coal could then be used for Arnott at an increased price. You agree that Optimum coal was then sold to provide coal at Arnott. You agree with that?
I don't recall that. But if you say so, then we will take it on.
But you indicated earlier, you were part of that committee that sat when you arrived there to look at the contracts that were coming to an end and the contracts that weren't going to be renewed. And let's have a look at them then, if I might remind you. The XRA cost-plus contract to supply owner that came to an end might legitimately have been a very expensive one, 1,000 Rand, and you considered not extending that. That was on the 31st of December 2015. The second honored contract, this time with Mafube, that was a joint venture between Exxaro and Anglo American. That coal was mined just north of the N12 highway and supplied a conveyor belt system to honored, a conveyor belt system. Okay? Now, the Denton's report, you remember the Denton's report? Was that the report that you didn't want to give out? According to Mr. Kwama, who gave evidence here, the communications guy, he said you would not prepare to release the Denton's report. You only wanted to release a redacted version. Is that correct?
Me personally, as in announcing?
You, working together with the board. But his evidence was he mentioned you by name. And I'm sure your lawyers were sitting here, they could vouch for that.
I deny that.
Okay, but that's by the way. But according to Denton's report, it shows that in July 2015, Mafube produced the cheapest coal on Eskom's books at 132 rand per ton. Do you remember that or not?
I do not, sir.
But you were supposed to look into these issues when you did the due diligence on the Tegeta contract. Because this was one of the contracts that came to an end.
So as I mentioned earlier in my testimony, the operational issues relating to...
Sorry, Mr. Singh, we're running late. I'm tired.
Sorry, ma'am.
I'm also struggling to hear you. And can I just ask you to pass it off to the operational people? You see, you're a director. You're the financial director. You have to accept responsibility. You also indicated that you chaired or you sat on this committee that dealt with these contracts, what was the scope of that committee that dealt with the ending of these contracts? You would get operational people that would come and report to you, but you had to take those decisions yourself.
The committee that we're talking about is a primary energy steering committee. It was established, I would assume, way after the transactions that you are mentioning, or you mentioned currently around the Exxaro contract and so on and so forth. It was, I think, established in early 2016, somewhere around there, if I recall correctly. So it would not have had sight of all of the contracts that you mentioned. Again, I'm standing to correction, but I think so. In terms of the second question that you posed,
now I'll give you the benefit of the doubt then, as far as that committee is concerned. But the point that I want to make is the Mafube contract with a conveyor belt system to the Arnott mine had been operating since 2004, had delivered 1.8 million tons per year to Arnott, and it was to go on until the end of 2023. Now, the Exxaro spokesman, Mr. Mzila Mtenjani, said the contract came to an end. Eskom's decision to terminate the contract without reason in December 2015. Everything happened in December 2015. And that's the answer that I was looking for. That's the answer, because that contract should have run on. Suddenly, there's an emergency at Arnott. Emergency supplies. You can deviate from the contract provisions. You can get optimum coal at a much increased price to go to Arnott. And that's what happened. Because at the end of January 2016, 30-ton coal trucks were running from Optimum Mine to Arnott. And that is where Tegeta got the increase. And instead of getting 150 rand per ton for Hendrina, they were suddenly getting 420 odd rand per ton for supplying Optimum coal to Arnott. That is one of the reasons why the public protector said Eskom leant over backwards to accommodate Tegeta. And that is the overwhelming evidence, which you don't seem to grasp. You've got a lot of documentation, and it is helpful. I went through it in great detail, and I'm grateful for that. But you only tell half the story, because there's another side of it, which you could say was the operational people, you had knowledge of it. But remember, in terms of the Companies Act, you have to accept fiduciary duty. And you're not just a normal director, you are the CFO. And let me just remind you, chapter, section 76, Standards of Director's Conduct, that you are to act in good faith and for a proper purpose in the best interest of the company with the degree of care, skill and diligence that may be reasonably expected of a person having the general knowledge, skill and experience of that director. That director, that means you, Mr. Singh, that means you as a chartered accountant, not a normal person. You have a higher standard that is required of you. And we and this committee would submit that you failed in that responsibility. You failed. Dismally. And we see the developments, and we see that you try to portray that Eskom has improved on your watch, but it just flies against everything and the evidence that we've heard. Take the Trillion contract. We had the Trillion people come in here and telling us the work was not necessary. You must have read that evidence. They said they were upset. They said that Eskom could have done that work themselves. The G9 forensics investigation into Trillion. Trillion became the illegitimate beneficiary of funds on the back of a turnaround project which McKinsey was supposed and contracted to undertake. This is the G9 forensic investigation. You're aware of it? You might not have read it.
I'm aware of it. I've not
Let's just see what their conclusion is. It is our considered opinion that irrespective of whether Trillium provided the services or not, Mr. Anuj Singh was in direct contravention of several fundamental tenets of the Eskom procurement policy. That's directly against you.
I would then respectfully submit as well. Are you aware of the fact that G9 has retracted that report?
Well, that adds to the evidence that is against you. In addition, you've got the Trillium people coming here and telling us that the work was not necessary.
So I'll again respectfully request...
Sorry, I'm not finished. I'm not finished. And in fact, saying that the 600 million that was paid by Eskom to Trillium should be repaid. Did you follow that evidence at all? You may proceed.
The only curious comments that I have to make relating to the evidence by the Trillium employees is that they were part and parcel of a program that was deployed within Eskom. And during the period of their servicing Eskom, none of them saw fit to report to the steering committee that oversaw their work, that one, they were actually attending Eskom every day, not doing anything. They did not bother to inform myself, the group executives that they were reporting to, that they were actually at Eskom every day, just coming and eating and going back home, because that's what it amounts to. I find that very hard to believe, and it's actually curious. There were a number of Eskom employees. If you look at the entire Master Services Agreement, as we call it, there were 150 odd Eskom employees that were deployed across all of the work streams that were undertaken by McKinsey and Trillium. None of those individuals came to me and said, listen, Trillium is here and they're not doing anything. On the objective evidence that was before me, and in my own personal interactions, as I said to you before, as it's quoted in my evidence, the funding plan for the 14-15 or 15-16 corporate plan was 2 pages. How do you execute a borrowing program of excess 200 billion with a borrowing plan of 2 pages?
I understand that, and I accept what you say, but we also have Ms. Bianca Goodson that came and indicated that she would sit with Mr. Mashilikoka and would speak to him and express her frustrations at the supply development program of Trillium, that there was nothing happening, and that McKinsey would say, well, you're getting your cut, don't complain. And that moved her to tears, and we'll put that as well. So are you saying that that is not something that should be considered?
No, not at all. I think those concerns were raised with us, and I think if you look at one of the minutes of the steering committee that was established to manage the project, that was one of the reasons, one of the concerns that we raised with McKinsey. I think it was the first or the second steer code that we raised those concerns with McKinsey.
Can I just ask you now, Mr. Godon asked you at length about the financials. And it's a great concern to us, and I'm sure it should be of you as well and all people that are watching, is the state, the financial state of Eskom and the risk it poses to our whole economy, to the fiscus, to our guarantees. And you indicated in your term that there'd been a turnaround, and yes, the diesel was used far less, and there were some positive aspects. But let's just look at the financials up to March of 2017. 85% decline in pre-tax profit. Would you agree with that? 85%. That is what was indicated.
Agreed.
1 billion rand was your pre-tax profit, down from 5 billion rand the previous year. Would you say that that is on an asset basis that is estimated to be 710 billion rand. Isn't that appalling? That's not an improvement. That's actually shocking. And that is what many of the commentators, you would have read them, have said it's appalling. It's scandalous, in fact.
Our response to that, as explained in the results presentation, was that, yes, it's a concern in terms of the drop from 5 to 1. But from an ESCOM perspective and a rating agency perspective, the rating agencies are more concerned around cash profits. The difference between 5 and 1 is by and large the increase in interest as well as depreciation. And from a depreciation perspective, that's non-cash cost, and also the increase in taxation, which was primarily deferred taxation, which is not a cash cost. So hence we measure particularly an organization such as ESCOM, which is a relatively capital-intensive business, on EBITDA, which is earnings before interest, taxation, and amortization, which effectively showed increases, as I outlined before, as well as the fact that that EBITDA increase has to be reflected in your cash generated from operations, because that then effectively assures you that whatever profits that you are generating actually is converted into cash. And if you compare the increases in EBITDA and the increases in cash generated from operations, they relatively dovetail.
Thank you. And that's a very complex explanation, which I accept. But at the end of the day, I, as a lame person, read 1 billion down from 5 billion. That's what I read. And that's what I accept. And so to me, it's not an improvement at all. The 20 billion rand cost saving, was that not mainly because of lower sales meant primary energy costs were down and there was less diesel in particular that was used and coal? Is that not the main challenge, is that your energy costs were totally down?
Energy costs were down. In my view, the 20 billion cost savings was in 2017, and that was by and large all coal cost savings. In 2015-16, the 17 billion was largely attributable to the reduction in diesel usage. And again, you may say that it's volume related, but it's pretty much a small portion of that is volume related, but by and large, I would say 90% of it is related to the improvement in the energy availability factor in 15-16, and then 16-17, as I said, the biggest chunk of that is related to the increase in the productivity of the cost plus mines.
The interest costs ballooned by 82%, 82% during that year. Is that correct? That's the information I have, 82%.
It did increase. I'm not sure.
And that's massive.
Yes.
That is according to the financial statements.
Yes.
That's not an achievement. That's dismal.
Yes, but there's a reason for that, sir.
Well, of course. You see, you're offering reasons for all this, but put it all together, and it shows a dismal financial situation.
Well, if you look at my statements, my opening paragraph or opening pages basically said that when I got there, the financial sustainability of ESCOM was a concern, and is still a concern. And actually, it's exacerbated by NERSA's recent decision of a 5% tariff increase.
Well, I think, sorry, it's aggravated,
yes,
by the action of the board. It's not NERSA's fault. It's the action of the board and management at ESCOM. That, to me, don't blame them, because this is a continual problem, that NERSA is blamed for not giving a sufficient increase. That increase has to be passed on to the consumer. When ESCOM is wasting funds, let's just look at the irregular expenditure. 3 billion rand irregular expenditure, which was up from 348 million the previous year. So don't blame NERSA when ESCOM is wasting the money. Would you agree with that?
So I would, to an extent, I think there is a case to be made relating to irregular and fruitless and wasteful expenditure. But by and large, if you look at an entity as large as ESCOM, I find it difficult as a finance person to understand how an entity as large as ESCOM can survive with a 2% tariff increase in 1 year and a 5% tariff increase in another. By and large, over 2 years, if you combine the two tariff increases, you get a 7% tariff increase. On average, that's a 3.5% tariff increase per year, when inflation, general inflation in the country is at about 6%. So I find